This is a CBS News special. 1974, a television album, with CBS News correspondent John Hart.
Good evening. This year came in primary colors, the softer tones missing somehow in the events that fixed our eyes on the primary values: survival, justice, decency. Years usually come in uniform sizes, but this time the canvas seemed to grow to take all the strokes of history. Watergate, confession by resignation, innocence by pardon, inflation, recession, starvation, the fall of governments, the rising power of the Persian Gulf, the limits of energy. Much of it happened elsewhere, but it pushed in on all of us who are no longer immune from the world. It used to be that television told us mainly what happened to others. This year, it showed what was happening to us.
1974, a television album, is sponsored by Reynolds Aluminum, conserving our resources and energy. And by Bufferin, the headache tablet that gives you fast relief and is easy on your stomach.
99, 100, and still climbing. The heat's on, the fever of a cold or the flu, with all those body aches and pains. Turn down the heat with Bufferin. Bufferin has one of the most effective fever reducers known, and Bufferin starts rushing its pain reliever to all those aches and pains twice as fast as plain aspirin, and helps protect you from the stomach upset plain aspirin can cause. When the heat's on from a cold or the flu, turn it down with Bufferin.
Important guests and, burning fat. One of those sudden household odors where you worry and worry.
Is something burning?
Because it's so embarrassing. Now, let's see what would happen with Renews It Spray. Renews It Spray Air Freshener. Renews It sprays away the worry of sudden household odors, so there's no embarrassment. Renews It Spray Air Freshener sprays away the worry of sudden odors.
Here again is John Hart.
The gentleman who started this country couldn't think of everything. They couldn't know, for example, that the president would become a more powerful symbol of the nation than the flag. When he waves, we take notice. They did figure that all presidents would be foolish sometimes, that some of them would be unpopular, even corrupt. It occurred to them some president might get into trouble so deep he would quit. But they could not imagine the circumstances that would eventually make that happen. Neither could many presidents.
I have no intention whatever of ever walking away from the job that the people elected me to do. We have a lot of work left to do, more than 3 years left to do, and I'm going to stay here till I get it done.
It also takes courage to stand and fight for what you believe is right, and that's what I intend to do.
I will not be a party to the destruction of the presidency of the United States.
I shall resign the presidency effective at noon tomorrow.
The presidency was not destroyed. That president was. Here's Dan Rather's account.
He began the year trying to get people to forget Watergate crimes.
1 year of Watergate is enough.
Time and again he tried.
Dragging out Watergate drags down America, and I want to bring it to a conclusion as quickly as we can.
The materials I make public tomorrow will provide all the additional evidence needed to get Watergate behind us, and to get it behind us now.
He had not made available all of the additional evidence about crimes and cover-ups. The public did not know that then, but people continued to sense that the full truth somehow was being concealed.
What about other materials that the committee might want to see that the prosecutor didn't see?
And the courts, plus the special prosecutor's office, continued to pursue the truth. In the House, the Judiciary Committee was making new headlines every day as its proceedings on the possible impeachment of the president continued. The White House response was to attack the fairness and credibility of the committee. And there were sudden forays by the president, trying to prove that he had major support still, and that he was still in charge of the government and of himself.
Now, jerky back.
Thank you. I'll stay here and try to learn how to use the yo-yo. You'll go up and be president, bro.
He went on tours abroad, trying to continue the momentum of his earlier foreign policy successes. In a visit almost as surprising as his trip to Peking, he went to Egypt and was heartened by the cheers of throngs of people rallied for the occasion by Egyptian President Sadat. And he went back to the scene of earlier successes in Moscow to bolster his claim to a very special personal relationship that was said to be vital to the continuation of détente. But none of the attempts at diversion worked. On July 24th, the Supreme Court ruled unanimously that Mr. Nixon must surrender more tapes after all. 3 days later, the House Judiciary Committee, voting in full view of the nation, reached its first vote on impeachment, charging the president with obstruction of justice.
Mr. Cohen.
Aye.
Mr. Chairman.
Clerk will report.
27 members have voted aye. 11 members have voted no.
But the impeachment trial never came. On August 5th, White House recordings gave final proof. The president had known about Watergate and the cover-up shortly after the break-in itself. And Mr. Nixon issued a statement conceding that his public statements denying knowledge had been, quote, at variance with the facts, which was to say, he had lied. The morning after his resignation address to the nation, the president called together the White House staff to bid them farewell.
Ladies and gentlemen, the President of the United States of America and Mrs. Nixon, Mr. and Mrs. David Eisenhower.
In a half-hour, disjointed, emotional talk, the president spoke of his father and mother, and seemingly of himself, when he read what young Theodore Roosevelt had written when his wife died.
He thought the life had gone from his life forever, but he went on. And he not only became president, but as an ex-president, he served his country, always in the arena, tempestuous, strong, sometimes wrong, sometimes right. But he was a man. And as I leave, let me say, that's an example I think all of us should remember.
Before he had been forced to admit his role in the cover-up, Mr. Nixon had been fond of counting the days left to him as president and saying what he wanted to do for the nation in that remaining time. But there were still 894 days left in his second term when Richard Nixon bade farewell to the nation for the last time as president.
In terms of money and property and compared to most Americans, Mr. Nixon left office wealthy. His potential wealth from pensions, book rights, personal papers, and so on is even greater. Still, according to the best available evidence and testimony, life for him is, and seems destined to remain, a kind of living hell. His physical illness has been documented as real and serious. Little is known publicly from a medical standpoint about his mental and emotional health. Logic, however, leads to the conclusion that he is, at the very least, troubled by thoughts of what might have been, and by what history's final judgment may be on a president who left proof positive in his own voice that he deliberately lied to his people in order to conceal crimes.
Richard Nixon governed as if he preferred the judgment of history over the judgment of his countrymen. By contrast, his successor, Gerald Ford, took office by declaring a difference.
Our long national nightmare is over. Our Constitution works. Our great republic is a government of laws and not of men. Here, the people rule.
Our first unelected president started the new job the way many of us begin the day, commuting from a home in the suburbs to an office downtown. After work, he liked to unwind with a swim in the backyard pool.
This isn't a burlesque, you know, right?
His friend said Gerald Ford had never wanted to be president and never thought much about the office. He had planned to run one more time for his seat in Congress and then retire from public life. When moving day arrived, he was convinced that the time had come to open up the presidency, to make it less majestic, less imperial. When the movers overlooked a few things, this president retrieved them himself.
What are you taking with you?
Parachute tree. My high school annual.
A president who made his own breakfast was such a change that how he went about it became big news.
Photographers jockeyed for position to get those first photos of the toasting of the presidential muffins. New president and his family didn't seem to mind having the photographers around, and we began to see them everywhere. When the Russian cosmonauts came to town, the president took them to a family picnic being sponsored by one of the area's suburban police departments. The next day, the president's mood would suddenly turn somber as he made a surprise announcement from the Oval Office.
A full, free, and absolute pardon unto Richard Nixon.
The pardon of Richard Nixon stunned the nation. As his own standing in the popularity polls plunged, the president convened a domestic summit conference. In the midst of that, personal tragedy struck. Doctors discovered his wife had breast cancer.
Just one personal note, if I might. I just returned from the hospital where I saw Betty as she came from the operating room. Dr. Lou Cash has assured me that she came through the operation all right.
The news about Mrs. Ford was soon better. The economy was not responding to treatment, and the president went on the road. In Mexico, he drew big crowds as he stressed the traditional ties of friendship between the two hemisphere neighbors. He was soon crisscrossing his own country, calling for the election of more Republicans to Congress. He spoke, he pleaded, he wore funny hats. He kissed girls. Once he even centered a football for the Republican cause. It was an exhausting effort, but the Republicans took a drubbing. The candidates the president campaigned for seemed to do no better or worse than the other. He was soon on the go again, this time overseas. He was the first American president to go to Japan. His aide said that symbolism was the most important thing about the trip. In neighboring Korea, he got one of those welcomes the Koreans are famous for. Later, he had a chance to visit with the American troops still stationed there. In Vladivostok, he traded quips with Soviet Party leader Brezhnev. During a two-hour train ride to the summit site, and still later in the compound where the talks were held, they played to the cameras. As the talk turned serious, they worked out an arms agreement. They called it an agreement to cap the arms race. Critics said it would fuel the arms race, and the issue seemed headed for a long debate in Congress. The president did have better luck with Congress on another issue. After months of investigation, Congress confirmed Nelson Rockefeller, the president's choice, to fill the vice presidential vacancy.
On which I'm about to enter.
So help me God.
So help me God.
Gerald Ford had no chance to formulate his programs before he came to office, and the problems that confronted him were enormous. He thought the first priority was to change the tone of the presidency and restore a sense of decency there. He's been able to do that, and even his critics give him high marks in that area. He has been less successful in other areas. The arms agreement remains a source of controversy. The new energy compromise with the French may lead to a better approach to solving the energy mess, but domestic energy policy and other economic cures remain subjects of debate. New proposals are expected next year and may bring changes, but the problems are still enormous. And except for the changes in style, the only thing that Gerald Ford has really been able to change so far this year is the fate of Richard Nixon.
The pardon stopped with Richard Nixon. 35 people from his administration and his reelection committee were charged with crimes. There have been two acquittals so far, 29 convictions or admissions of guilt. Fred Graham reports.
Charles Colson, once confidant and counsel to former President Nixon, 1 to 3 years. John Dean, counsel to Mr. Nixon, 1 to 4 years. Herbert Kalmbach, Mr. Nixon's personal attorney, 6 to 18 months. Jeb Stuart Magruder, deputy director of the Nixon re-election campaign, 10 months to 4 years. Eagle Crowe, co-director of the White House Plumbers Unit, 6 months. Richard Kleindienst, former attorney general, suspended sentence. Dwight Chapin, appointment secretary to the president, convicted of perjury and sentenced to 10 to 30 months, conviction appealed. John Ehrlichman, chief of the domestic council, convicted of conspiracy and perjury in connection with the Ellsberg break-in and sentenced to 20 months to 5 years, conviction appealed. Former Attorney General John Mitchell and former Commerce Secretary Marie Stans, accused of bribery and conspiracy along with fugitive financier Robert Vesco, found not guilty. The fourth former member of Mr. Nixon's cabinet to be accused of crimes, John Connally, was indicted for bribery and perjury. The trial is scheduled for next March. But most important of them all was the Watergate cover-up case, the trial of the heavyweights of the Nixon administration. John Mitchell brought to trial for the second time this year, John Ehrlichman also indicted for the second time, and H.R. Haldeman, who once ran the Nixon White House with an iron hand, were accused of conducting a massive conspiracy out of the White House to obstruct justice and cover up Watergate. Two lesser figures were also tried, Robert Mardian, a former Justice Department official, and Kenneth Parkinson, an attorney for the re-election committee. The high point was to have been the testimony of Richard Nixon, but his ill health made it dangerous for him to be questioned, and Judge John Sirica decided to complete the trial without him. It had been thought that Watergate would quickly fade into history and that the special prosecutor's office would disband in March. But recently, Special Prosecutor Ruth has been asking staff attorneys to stay on. Investigations are still underway of 10 more possible White House crimes, and it appears that Watergate will still be active in the courts beyond the first anniversary of Richard Nixon's resignation.
The regeneration of life. How does nature do it? It's simple. Nothing is ever wasted. Everything is used to continue nature's life cycle. Only when the cycle is broken does waste begin. Reynolds Aluminum is concerned about waste. We often carelessly discard things that should be recycled. All it takes is a little effort from each of us. These aluminum cans can be used again, regenerated, saving energy and material. In fact, recycling takes only 5% of the energy it took to make the aluminum from virgin ore. Reynolds started the first aluminum can recycling program. Today, Reynolds is recycling over 1 billion cans a year. Regeneration. If nature can do it, so can we. Reynolds Aluminum, conserving our resources and energy.
When hard times start coming on, the government worries about how people feel. There are those who say confident people make a sound economy. There are others who say it's a sound economy that makes people confident. Some say it's both. Anyway, peppy talk is easier to make than a peppy economy, so this year, as bad got worse, there was a while there when we argued as much over what to call it as what to do about it.
I do not think the United States is in a recession. We do have economic problems. It is imperative that we fight both inflation and recession at the same time.
The president was the last to admit we have a recession. By the time he did, unemployment was up to 6.5%, the highest since 1961. The mystery was that unemployment did not cure inflation as it used to. Inflation is now running at its highest rate, 12.2%. The first big inflationary leap came in the cost of fuel, when the price of imported oil quadrupled. Other prices were pushed up by producers. Food prices jerked upward again and again, up 12% in 12 months. Sugar, most spectacularly, by more than 400%. And the grains that the world's poor eat for their protein went up even faster than middle-class meats. Spring floods, summer drought, and a killing early frost ended hopes for a record harvest. With all costs up, cattle feeders claimed they couldn't sell animals for enough to bring them to full market size.
Them pictures they're showing of foreign kids starving to death. You'll have them right here to home. There's no excuse for it whatsoever in the land of plenty. Now I got work.
To publicize the squeeze, they killed young animals and buried them. Everything else was up. Transportation, 16%. Steel, 41%. Automobiles, 10.5%. Unsold cars filled the lots, and 200,000 workers were laid off in the automobile industry alone. In the first weeks of the Ford administration, Treasury Secretary Simon targeted the economic dangers.
The present primary danger is inflation. And nothing could be more disastrous than to direct our policies to fighting a depression that does not exist at the expense of our efforts against a virulent inflation that does.
A so-called economic summit was called.
I do not think we are going to come to grips with the mounting problems of the economy unless we begin to move in the direction of, one, establishing as needed mandatory wage, price, rent, and profit controls.
The fact is that there's no other way of dealing with the wage price spiral save by that.
Obviously, the easy way to fight inflation is to have a depression. And that surely will bring prices down. We all remember, or at least some of us remember, the last depression. And prices went way down. But if anything that this summit should agree upon is that a depression is not a solution to our problem. But a depression is precisely the direction in which this economy is headed.
The summit meetings were little more than cosmetic. The president's proposal for dealing with the problems of the economy stressed a volunteer effort.
There will be no big federal bureaucracy set up for this crash program. Through the courtesy of such volunteers from the communication and media fields, a very simple enlistment form will appear in many of tomorrow's newspapers along with a symbol of this new mobilization, which I'm wearing on my lapel. It bears the single word, win. I think that tells it all. I will call upon every American to join in this massive mobilization and stick with it until we do win as a nation and as a people.
By you are, and so am I. Win together, lose never. You can win, so can I.
A war against inflation, an awfully big battle for a song and a slogan. But now we have recession too, and stronger tactics are called for. Yet unless the Ford administration ends its confusion over economic policy, the public confidence needed to halt the decline will continue to slide. As for the Democrat-controlled Congress, its cry for action is not without political considerations. Because the economy is unlikely to cure itself, the outlook is for higher unemployment, slower growth, and more inflation, possibly lasting until the 1976 election.
Slower growth, that is scary, because up to now, growth was the abiding virtue of our economy. Produce more, sell more, have more. But like all virtues, it is demanding. One thing it demands is plenty of cheap energy. We don't have plenty of cheap energy anymore. And the virtue of growth is beginning to have some of the effects of a vice. Nelson Benton reports.
American motorists started this year in lines at the gas pump, burning then precious fuel in small amounts as they waited to get more, waiting an hour or more at times. Some places there were no lines, no gas, in fact. 50 miles an hour was the rule in most states, and then people obeyed. 1974 began with an apparent determination to act firmly to solve the energy crisis.
1974 must be the year in which we organize a full-scale effort to provide for our energy needs not only in this decade, but through the 21st century.
1974 ends with solutions still eluding the Congress, the people, and a new president.
Well, I must confess that we haven't done as well in Project Independence as I think most of us had hoped.
When 1974 began, the hottest issue on Capitol Hill was energy. Everybody had a bill, or several bills, to lead us out of the energy mess. Oil company executives spent as much time in congressional hearing rooms as they did in their counting rooms. Profits were the reason they were there.
The time has come to cut off these tax breaks to the major oil companies of America. This is another way that I believe you are cheating the American public.
At year's end, the profit picture looked like this: a spectacular upward march, even with the increased costs of doing business. Despite congressional vows to reduce them, at year's end, the oil industry still enjoys the same tax breaks as before. As the year ends, the bill for business as usual, consumption as usual, keeps mounting, draining away billions in our balance of trade. Some feel that a rationing plan of some sort would not be the worst that could happen. Millions of rationing stamps are in storage, printed up last winter just in case. In place of forced conservation, the administration pushed volunteerism. But imports continued to rise, so did speeds on the highways. The carrot wasn't tasty, and the stick did not exist. Administrations changed, but the volunteer concept did not.
We believe that the American people will respond to our volunteer program.
The energy crisis did change some things, though. It oiled the passage of the Alaska Pipeline Bill, fueled renewed interest in shale oil, although substantial shale oil production is still years away. Coal, called the sleeping giant of domestic resources, was still slumbering. In fact, it endured the nightmare of a nationwide strike as well. The shortfall of Project Independence is due in part to a lack of continuity in leadership and parallel bureaucratic bickering and turf grabbing. When the Arab producers turned off the spigot and turned on the crisis, Interior Secretary Rogers Morton was nominally in charge of national energy policy. He gave way to former Colorado Governor John Love, who gave way to Deputy Treasury Secretary William Simon, who gave way to John Sawhill as head of the Energy Agency, whose policy role then passed back to Rogers Morton, the head of the Energy Resources Council. In February, the United States sought to pull the consuming nations together at an energy conference in Washington. And as the year ends, there are some signs of progress toward that aim. The United States tried, too, to get oil prices down by persuasion and efforts toward increased economic cooperation, and when that failed, by tough talk.
The exorbitant prices can only distort the world economy, run the risk of a worldwide depression, and threaten the breakdown of world order and world safety.
Some thought the president was hinting at military action in the oil crisis, which he said he was not, and which did not occur, but neither did oil prices fall. They went up as the year wound down. The inevitable, then, some tough talk and stern measures for the American public on saving fuel and boosting domestic production to start kicking the habit of rising oil imports and their economic pain. We'll know more about how tough and how stern when Mr. Ford formally assesses the State of the Union and sets an energy course for the months and years to come.
The crises of energy and economy have put the rich Western countries in the same gunny sack. Middle East politics is the drawstring. As long as the oil countries pull together, they can use oil as a slipknot, cinching us up or not at will. Another war would invite another oil embargo. So what happens in the Middle East is no longer a distant political threat. It is a near economic one, aimed at the way we live. What happened there this year when we come back?
Now that you're wearing it,
How does it feel?
Soft, smooth, delicious.
Announcing Free Spirit Bra gives softness a little support. Cool Trico cups with a secret seam that shapes without showing for today's fluid, natural line. This filmy stretch smooths every move. Free Spirit Bra. From Playtex, give softness a little support.
You and me, we've been through a lot. Camp Lejeune, the wife, three kids. But when those twin blade razors came along, I almost left you.
Keep your double-edged razor and get a twin-blade shave with Schick's 2002, the first twin double-edged blade. Two edges on each side to shave extra close with each stroke, plus Teflon, plus rounded corners for safety.
Now it's you and me all the way, thanks to 2002.
The single most important event for the Middle East did not happen there. It happened here at the United Nations, where a man without a country, without a government, was treated as a legitimate leader of both. Bringing us back to why the fighting began in the first place. Two peoples who wanted the same land. It arrested a good deal of the year's diplomacy by Secretary Kissinger. It arrested none of the year's passions, Marvin Kalb reports.
Kiryat Shmona, Ma'alot, and other settlements became battlefields, tragic symbols of the continuing war between terrorist and civilian. In October, Kissinger's effort to promote an Arab-Israeli settlement ran into two roadblocks. The first was planted in Rabat, when 21 Arab leaders, including Yasser Arafat of the Palestine Liberation Organization, agreed that from then on, the PLO would be the sole representative of all the Palestinian people, and that Arafat could negotiate for control over the West Bank, those Israeli-occupied lands west of the Jordan River. The second roadblock appeared at the UN General Assembly debate in early November. Arafat, no chief of state, was given a hero's welcome. He called, in effect, for the dissolution of Israel and the creation of a Palestinian state. The pressure on Israel increased. Arabs demonstrated on the West Bank, showing their pro-Arafat feelings for the first time. Israel's economy suffered. Prime Minister Yitzhak Rabin had to declare a program of austerity. A massive devaluation of the Israeli currency touched off rioting. The Israeli citizen against the Israeli government. After a few days, the rioting subsided. But most Israelis realized there were tough challenges ahead.
And so the year ended on a note of uncertainty. Kissinger's step-by-step approach was jolted by a sudden boost in PLO stature and by Russia's insistence on a quick return to the Geneva conference. The secretary is now trying to salvage his approach. He often seems like a diplomat racing against the clock, investing effort and hope in another Egyptian-Israeli deal in the next month or two to head off not only the appearance of deadlock, but also the possibility of another Arab-Israeli war, and with that, another oil embargo.
History, like physics, seems to obey Newton's third law of motion. For every action, there is an equal and opposite reaction. In human affairs, push invites shove. Sometimes the reaction takes a while, but it came in three totalitarian countries this year, where the old order fell. The first was in April in Portugal, ruled by Marcelo Caetano. Drained by 13 years of war in three colonies, the dictatorship was pushed over by the army. The new president was a general whom Caetano had fired for wanting to give the colonies some self-government, Antonio de Spinola. But the tide was running more to the left, which wanted the colonies cut loose, independent. After 4.5 months, Spinola had to resign, leaving the power to the leftist generals, to the new president, Castro Gomez, and the premier, Gonzalez, who designed the revolution. Gonzalez talks of elections this March, but says unexpected events could prevent them. The next order to fall was on Cyprus, ruled by Archbishop Makarios, an island where the descendants of Greeks and the descendants of Turks lived, as a poet said, on the yeast of the bitterness between them. More Greeks than Turks by 4-1. Makarios wasn't anxious enough to join the island to Greece, so the dictatorship in Athens contrived a coup. Makarios escaped with his life, replaced by a former Greek guerrilla, Nikos Samson. 5 days later, Turkey invaded Cyprus, and 3 days after that, Samson resigned, giving the presidency to Glafkos Klarides, who had been president of the Cypriot House. Turkey occupied the northern third of the island when in December Makarios returned, not as president, more as a prince to the Greek majority. In July, 3 days after the Turks invaded Cyprus, the military dictatorship over in Greece, whose meddling invited the invasion, resigned. George Papadopoulos, who had ruled Greece for 7 years, was arrested and sent to an Aegean island. King Constantine had been in exile for 7 years, and in December, the Greeks removed this last remnant of the old order, voting to abolish the throne, leaving Constantine Karamanlis premier of the first civilian government in Greece since 1967. Ethiopia, where life is about as it was in the Middle Ages, still at the mercy of famine, where tens of thousands starved to death in 1974, still subject to an absolute emperor, Haile Selassie, who called himself the elect of God, the conquering lion of Judah, and a blood descendant of King Solomon. 82 years old, he had ruled for more than half a century when the army mutinied and then began to chew away his power, until in September he was quietly removed. Replaced by General Aman Andam and a military committee of 120 men. 2 months later, Aman was killed with 59 others, including a grandson of the fallen emperor. At the moment, Ethiopia is led by General Tafari Benti and an altered military committee, which is proceeding with trials of people who supported the Lion of Judah, as the new leaders themselves once did. Strange, isn't it, how power seems unchallengeable until the right challenge comes. Then we can see how fragile even great power can be. Despots know this too, and that's why they try to suffocate challenge, as the leaders of Russia tried to do with Alexander Solzhenitsyn. That is why they threw him out of his country. In Zurich, Switzerland, with his family, he is still writing of the hundreds of thousands of people who spent and spend their lives in Soviet prisons because an attitude or a conversation appeared a danger to those who called themselves the state.
I started seriously working in the camp in the 1948, but there, every day, I had to think about what I'd written. Where could I hide it? But then maybe somebody would come at night. But here I can write it, put it away, and go to sleep peacefully.
Russians cannot buy Solzhenitsyn's book, The Gulag Archipelago. It is an exposure of Russia's political prisons. But in 1974, the rest of the world could, and that was enough for his arrest.
They charged me with being a traitor, which involved the death penalty, a shooting. So on the very first evening of my arrest, they told me I would be shot. I was ready for it. There was no other way of getting out of the situation.
There was another way. Solzhenitsyn had often said that exile was a form of death. His Soviet life was executed in exile. Where he continues to write and speak of a life and country where there are no guarantees.
International detente does nothing to help the situation inside the Soviet Union. Tell me, please, let's be realists. What kind of guarantees are there that the treaties will be fulfilled today or tomorrow?
In exile, Solzhenitsyn finally accepted the Nobel Prize for Literature, which he had won 4 years ago, a prize the Russian leaders considered an insult to them and to communism, a prize which Solzhenitsyn said had prevented him from being crushed in their persecutions.
You
can do your own thing with fun and with flair. You can go through the day with hardly a care, with the natural look, the natural feeling, to know you're the best you can be.
Natural Wear Miss Clairol, the improved hair color that conditions, covers gray, looks and wears so natural week after week. Try Natural Wear Miss Clairol hair color.
To know you're the best you can be.
Fasten your seatbelts.
This is the pilot's first flight, sir.
Oh, no, sir. Yes, you want a blanket?
Great,
just a bit of turbulence, sir.
Even when you can't hold up any longer, your hair can with Finalmid. It's not an aerosol hairspray. It's Clairol's clear mist you spritz on once to hold three times longer than the best-selling hairspray. Finalmid holds up longer than you do.
We'll be circling another half hour, folks.
The embarrassment of the Argentine firecracker bothered Wilbur Mills badly. More than it bothered his voters, who re-elected him after his friendship with a stripper was discovered. It bothered him so much, he made it worse. In Boston, on stage.
We're canceling the show.
Which show?
After New York.
No. No more shows after New York? No, that's not true.
No. We are.
No, that's not true.
Well, you know it is.
Perhaps the medicine he took for his backaches did it. Perhaps it was the humiliation of running for president unnoticed. Perhaps it was his time of life. His novel behavior lost him one job as chairman of the Ways and Means Committee, and he's thinking of quitting the Congress. "This won't ruin me," he said in Boston. "Nothing can ruin me." Too much of nothing did. There is another powerful man who discovered this year how fame made him vulnerable, William Randolph Hearst. On February 4th, his third daughter, Patricia, was kidnapped, not for ransom only, for revolution. On April 3rd, Patricia sent out a picture of herself and a tape saying she was changing her name to Tanya, that she was not brainwashed, and that her father, the San Francisco publisher, was a liar. 2 weeks later, a hidden camera photographed her robbing a San Francisco bank. Another tape from Tanya said she was a willing outlaw and that her parents were pigs. She wasn't satisfied with the $2 million of food for poor people, which her kidnappers, the Symbionese Liberation Army, demanded. Her parents had not done enough, she said. She joined the SLA. In May, six members of the SLA died in a shootout with Los Angeles police and in a fire started by tear gas grenades. Patricia was somewhere else. The FBI now calls her an armed and dangerous fugitive. There's one kind of picture that is startling because it makes us think we've seen it somewhere before. We had one of those recently. Calling up a picture of Selma, Alabama in the 1960s, sheriff's deputies riding through a crowd of blacks who wanted integration. In 1974, it was Boston, where mounted police rode through a crowd of whites who did not want integration.
I hope it's another Belfast.
Why do you hope that?
Why? Shoot all the niggas.
Why?
Because why should they come over here and wreck this city?
Why should they take over
that school?
A federal judge figured the Constitution required black students be sent to white schools and white students to black schools.
White kids probably just hate us, period. Just don't like us at all. Just don't want us around there, so we don't want them around up here.
The violence of grown-ups outside poisoned the schools inside. Stabbings, beatings, a constant sense of danger, and not much education.
If that's the way everyone feels, I mean, why should anyone go to school?
Americans heard, talked, saw, read, and thought more about justice this year than in a long time. All kinds of justice: unequal, delayed, betrayed, obstructed. A good many took to feeling as Clarence Darrow, the great lawyer, did after a lifetime of looking for it and pleading for it. There is no justice, he decided, in or out of court. But we kept the process of looking for it going, because if we didn't, we wouldn't dispose of anything. We'd miss a sense of completion that a verdict, fair or unfair, gives us. Three important injustices were completed by verdicts this year. Kent State, 4 students killed. Now, 4 years later, 8 National Guardsmen were tried for violating their civil rights by killing them. A federal judge acquitted them, saying their act was not condoned, but their intent was not proved. They are free and sad.
Nothing can really justify what happened on that hill that day.
Clarksville, Pennsylvania, the home of Joseph Yablonski, where he and his wife and daughter were murdered. Yablonski was a rival for power in the Mine Workers Union. Now, 5 years later, his rival, Tony Boyle, who was the union president, was wheeled out of a hospital to be tried for ordering the assassinations. Boyle had tried to kill himself and failed. He was convicted and sentenced to life. My Lai, South Vietnam. More than 100 villagers killed by American soldiers. Only one was convicted. Lieutenant William Calley. Now, 6 years after the massacre, Calley was paroled by the Army and then freed by a federal judge who said publicity made his trial unfair. Calley, who helped destroy My Lai, is looking for a job in the construction business. A deep thinker once said that people's diversions tell as much about them as the history of their battles or their art. There are sporting gents who consider themselves artists, and one of them, more than any others, raised his art to the level of history this year by what he did. What Hank Aaron did was break Babe Ruth's record of 714 career home runs. Historians will note that it happened in Atlanta, Georgia at 9:07 p.m. local time on April the 8th in the fourth inning off an Al Downing fastball on a windy, overcast day with the temperature at 62 degrees. Historians will also note that on November 15th, Aaron was traded to the Milwaukee Brewers. There was additional evidence this year that we are people who take frivolity seriously.
Sociologist Meyer Barash saw more than was displayed by the streakers. What he saw was disillusionment with social action. Mediaologist Marshall McLuhan studied on it a while and announced that what we had was an art form. Psychiatrist Robert Lifton at Yale analyzed it in relation to national security and concluded it was not a threat. Psychologist Philip Zimbardo at Stanford looked at all the data and came up with a fundamental discovery. Fundamentally, he said, it was a ploy to get attention. It worked. Philippe Petit had no excuse for sneaking into the World Trade Center in New York, throwing a wire between the towers, and walking on it. And more, a policeman saw it.
He was bouncing up and down. His feet were actually leaving the wire, and then he would resettle back on the wire again. And then he would go down on one knee, and he'd balance hand pole and lay down on his back and put his hands behind his neck and just completely relax and swing one of his legs over the wire in a carefree manner.
There is no why. Just because when I see a beautiful place to put my wire, I cannot resist.
Something has to be done with a man like that. So the perpetrator was arrested and sentenced to entertain some children.
It's hard to believe. If a person took off from New York and took 2 plain aspirin for a headache, on the average, she would still have most of that aspirin down in the stomach about 20 minutes later when she reached Philadelphia. But what if she took Bufferin instead when she left New York? It would be twice as fast as plain aspirin getting out of the stomach and going to the headache, and with less chance of the stomach upset aspirin can cause. Next headache, take Bufferin. Why wait? important guests, and, uh-oh, burning fat. One of those sudden household odors where you worry and worry.
Is something burning?
Because it's so embarrassing. Now, let's see what would happen with Renews It Spray. Renews It Spray Air Freshener. Renews It sprays away the worry of sudden household odors, so there's no embarrassment. Renews It Spray Air Freshener sprays away the worry of sudden odors.
As near as we can tell, some 125 million of us were born this year, and some 50 million of us died, leaving an additional 75 million looking for the good life, or at least work, or at the very least, food. There's no way of knowing how many died for lack of food. Tens of thousands, surely. Hundreds of thousands, maybe. In each one, the body consumed its own resources, burning its last defenses, surrendering to the nearest disease. There are many reasons: lack of water for crops, lack of transport for relief, and lack of caring. In Xenia, Ohio, and Brandenburg, Kentucky, and Monticello, Indiana, and Huntsville, Alabama, and God knows how many other places, it was lack of time and a hiding place. More than 300 people died in the traces of these moving fingers. And those who were left were lucky, whatever they lost.
We've been real lucky.
It looks as if you lost everything.
Just about. We just got each other now.
Near Paris, it was lack of a strong door. A cargo door popped off. The pressure collapsed. A DC-10 folded on itself. And 346 people died in the worst airplane crash there ever was. There's no way of knowing how many people were killed by other people, deliberately, in wars. They were not our wars this year, and we didn't keep track. But more than 20,000 Americans were murdered in less organized ways. Mrs. Martin Luther King was one of those, as her son had been 6 years ago. Others were taken by older enemies. Charles Lindbergh died of cancer, still a hero for flying the Atlantic alone without stopping. Earl Warren died of old age when he was 83. He thought groups were stronger than individuals and that groups were not always fair. While he was Chief Justice, the Supreme Court gave individuals more power in schools, in courts, and in politics. Walter Lippmann died of old age, too. He was 85. He was a journalist who wanted to be known as a political thinker, and he was. Those in high places, he thought and said, are more than administrators, more than writers of laws. They are the custodians of the nation's ideals. Wayne Morse died after 73 years, most of it speaking his mind. The senator from Oregon called Harry Truman a ham actor, Dwight Eisenhower a hypocrite, and Lyndon Johnson drunk with power. He called the war in Vietnam illegal, immoral, and a lot of other things. I use language people can understand, he said, clearly. Samuel Goldwyn died. He made gloves, then movies, then phrases like, include me out. Only the gloves are forgotten. William Daniel Deacon Jones was forgotten until he died in a quarrel of a shotgun. Then he was remembered for having driven Bonnie's and Clyde's getaway cars in the 30s. We lost a number of people who were in our homes so much that losing them was like stopping in the middle of a conversation. Chet Huntley, Frank McGee, Ed Sullivan,
Jack Benny.
But you know, Bob, while we've been talking, it just occurred to me how similar our careers have been. After all, we both did, you know, we both made quite a few pictures.
That's right.
And we both were in radio for a long time.
That's true.
We both went all over the world entertaining troops.
Yes, but I did it free.
Can I help with the boys threw money up on the stage?
And Duke Ellington. Endings. The year was made of them. We shrink from endings, but we have a need of them, as they offer release as well as sadness. What we want, of course, are neat endings. To escape admitting what the English novelist John Galsworthy claimed, that the beginnings and endings of all human undertakings are untidy. So we contrive some clean ones, dividing the flow of time into neat endings of minutes and hours and years. It's easy to feel untidy at the end of this year, tempting to feel a kind of despair, not hopelessness, but a knowledge of human limits. The year taught us that, goodness knows. Perhaps there's some use in the contrivance of the calendar, the pretense of new beginnings. A new year promises nothing tidy, but it gives a good excuse for hope, which we crave even more than endings. Because we scheme to live as John Dryden wished, never ending, still beginning, fighting still. I'm John Hart. Good night.